This is Age of Treason Radio.
First thing I remember was asking Papa why. For there were many things I didn't know.
On the White Network. With your host, Dan Stoffel.
Murder of Mary Fagan, Part 8. I'd like to speak more this time on the asymmetry of antisemitism and expand a bit on the Jews and violent crime and discuss Nathan Schwartz as a direct precedent for Leo Frank. I'll have some things to say about Jim Conley too, but I really doubt I'm going to get to that, and the bulk of that will probably have to wait until the next time. The asymmetry in antisemitism, after thinking about it a bit more this past week, is really due to the fact that there is no equivalence between whites and Jews. Whites aren't Jews, and Jews aren't white. And even there you see the asymmetry in that Jews recognize that they're not white, but whites don't recognize that. And behind that is that there is no equivalence between a host and a parasite. According to the Jews, if you try to hold a Jew like Leo Frank accountable for a crime, that's anti-Semitism. If you recognize that Jews are coming to a Jew's defense because they're Jews, that too, according to the Jews, is anti-Semitism. Now, sometimes non-Jews, the hosts, mistake this attitude for paranoia on the part of the Jews, that the Jews must be paranoid to think that everyone is out to get them. I think that psychological projection actually gets closer to the truth, that the Jews imagine everyone around them has the same kind of tribal, ethnic, racial loyalty that they do. They project their own thinking into other people's minds. And they also think that those other people are just as furtive about it as they are. So when Jews complain about anti-Semitism, as if it's some kind of cohesive anti-Jewish sentiment, that it's organized and coordinated, when it obviously isn't, they're actually just reflecting their own solidarity, their own group identity. I say when it's obvious that it isn't the case, the asymmetry that I'm talking about here is especially obvious when Jews complain about antisemitism in people who obviously don't hate, oppose, or even seem to recognize the Jews for what they are, who don't do the most obvious thing, which is to exclude the Jews from their society, to keep the Jews at arm's length across on the other side of a border, for instance. Like the relatively racially aware Southern whites, who, at least until the spectacle that the Jews made of themselves during the Frank trial, respected and welcomed the Jews, as we talked about the last time, and regarded them as quote-unquote white. But the Jews didn't reciprocate, and even before the Frank trial had ever happened, even before the murder had happened, the Jews saw themselves as separate, as they have throughout their long history. Now, toward the end last time, I talked about an article written by Scott Aaron, actually a whole website, leofrank.info. But I focused on one article in particular titled Why I Write. I'd like to pick some bones with that, get it a little deeper into something that I made a note of at the time. Scott Aaron, just to recall, was trying to strike an equivocal pose, calling for Jews to abandon their century-long, multi-generational pattern of unequivocally backing Frank, to the point of insisting that Frank was the real victim and that Jews as a group are the victims of Frank's trial and his lynching. And Aaron made this bizarre call for Jews to, quote, be prominent in leading the way, unquote, down a middle path between the truth and their previous attempts to invert reality and smear white Southerners as the wrongdoers. And I'll never forget, and I don't think anyone else who thinks about this case should, that the Jewish line on Frank, summing up their attitude about the whole Frank trial, is wrongly accused, falsely convicted, wantonly murdered. Now, how do you reconcile that Jewish line on Frank with Scott Aaron's description of how white Southerners viewed the Jews? He wrote, "If anything, they were seen as an unusually industrious, intelligent, and law-abiding segment of society, even if they were a bit peculiar in their religious views." And this attitude, in fact, traces back, as I discussed in a previous installment, to James Edward Oglethorpe, the leader of the first European colony in Georgia in 1733, when he first accepted Jews to live in Georgia, when they showed up unannounced. And it's also the same attitude that was behind why Jews were in England in the first place. Why the English respected and welcomed Jews who had fled Spain, where they had been respected and welcomed previously. And that in both cases, they were seen as members of the quote-unquote white society that just happened to have peculiar religious views. This is a recurring pattern throughout European history of Jewish infiltration. Now, Aaron also wrote in the sentence just before that one about Jews being seen as law-abiding and intelligent and industrious. He wrote, "Jews, furthermore, were not known for violent acts or crimes, nor feared as violators of white women." And I took issue with that the last time, and this time I think the bulk of what I'm going to talk about has to do with why I took issue with it and going into some of the details. First of all, I'd acknowledge myself I've fallen into this assumption. I think it's an apologetic view of Jews. It's not necessarily true. It's true in the sense that in this context, in contrast to, say, blacks, that it's true. Jews are not known for the kind of violent acts, these crimes committed on a whim, impulsively, as blacks are. That they are known for intelligence and meticulous planning and organizing. They're known for committing, or they would be known if they didn't so vehemently attack anyone who tried to establish this. They're known for premeditated violence, for political violence, for larger political or financial gain, to advance their group interests. That's what Jews are known for. And there's a two-word point I could make about that, and the two words are Murder, Inc. Murder, Inc. is the name, the unofficial name, for the Jewish mafia that was operating in the early part of the 20th century and probably continues to this day, just with out of the spotlight since the Jews have taken more overt control over the media and the government. But even the Wikipedia article, and Wikipedia is very heavily influenced by Jewish editors, even that Wikipedia article on Murder, Inc. has to acknowledge that it was essentially a Jewish mafia. And there's a particular section here I'd like to read that goes to this point about their cold calculating sensitivity about group interests, how they use their intelligence to commit acts of violence with the group's interests in mind. Probably their most well-known victim was Dutch Schultz, who was a Jew, by the way, who had openly defied the syndicate. In October 1935, Schultz insisted on putting a hit on Dewey. Dewey was the non-Jew prosecutor or district attorney, I'm not sure, G-man, basically, who was threatening legal action against the syndicate. Was going to crack down. So the syndicate considered killing him, but they decided against it. And Dutch Schultz. I should just continue reading because it kind of explains this. Dewey, who was leading an all-out effort to put the mob out of business, the syndicate board overruled Schultz. They feared, with good reason, that Dewey's murder would incite public outrage and result in an even greater campaign to shut down the rackets, the murder racket, that is. Schultz vowed that he would ignore the board's decision and kill Dewey himself. The board decided they needed to act immediately to kill Schultz before he killed Dewey. Therefore, in an ironic twist, Buchalter, who was the leader of the syndicate at the time, another Jew, actually saved Dewey's life and allowed Dewey to continue his efforts to bring down Buchalter. This led Shapiro, yet another Jew, part of the syndicate, to suggest years later that Schultz should have been allowed to kill Dewey, although at the time he supported the syndicate's decision to overrule Schultz. So you can see the calculation that's always going on in Jews' heads. You know, what's good for the Jews, or in this case, what's good for the Jews that are part of Murder, Inc.? What's in our best interests? And it involves murder as well. So there's one caveat and precedent about Jews being perfectly capable of violent crime. Another that I'll cite is what Kevin McDonald refers to as Stalin's willing executioners, Jews as a hostile elite in the USSR. And he's got a really breathtaking article about this, and that's the title of it. Just one section here to give you the gist of it. The Gulag was headed, and most people have heard of the Gulag. What most people probably haven't heard of is Jewish involvement in it. The Gulag was headed by ethnic Jews from its beginning in 1930 until the end of 1938, a period that encompasses the worst excesses of the Great Terror. They were, in Slezkind's words, Stalin's willing executioners. And this is from an article. It's a review of Yuri Slezkind's book titled The Jewish Century. Another interesting thing came up this past week on The International Jew with Carolyn Yeager and Hanning Scott this past Thursday. The chapter of The International Jew that they were reading from referred to the Leo Frank case. And this was from The International Jew, chapter 76. And this was 1920, 1921 that they were writing this. And they were well aware of the events in Russia. Again, let me just read this rather than trying to describe it myself. The title of the chapter is America's Jewish Enigma, Lewis Marshall. Lewis Marshall has appeared in all the great Jewish cause cases. The case of Leo Frank, a Jew, charged with the peculiarly vicious murder of a Georgia factory girl who was defended by Mr. Marshall. It was one of those cases where the whole world is whipped into excitement because a Jew is in trouble. It is almost an indication of the racial character of the culprit. Of a culprit these days, to note how much money is spent for him and how much fuss is raised concerning him. It seems to be a part of the Jewish loyalty to prevent, if possible, the Gentile law from being enforced against Jews. The Dreyfus case and the Frank case are examples of the endless publicity the Jews secure in behalf of their own people. So that actually gets to another point that I have brought up regularly in this series about the Jews considering themselves above and beyond the laws of the non-Jews amongst whom they live. And this, again, reflects the parasite-host asymmetry, that they see themselves as their own people. They don't see themselves as part of white society. Furthermore, in this article, it says that Marshall works on the principle that, quote, the Jew can do no wrong, unquote. And they're quoting themselves there from an earlier chapter. I could find no reference to Marshall actually saying that or any other Jew saying that, but I think it does accurately reflect the Jewish attitude that what's best for the Jews is what drives them. And they furthermore note a little further on, Jewish publicity did to Georgia what it did to Russia, and this is the connection with Russia, grossly misrepresenting it and so ceaselessly as to create a false impression generally. They talk a little further about the revolution in Russia, and this is directly connected to violence and political violence that Jews are capable of. When Russia fell, Lewis Marshall hailed it with delight. I won't read this whole thing. But basically, the Russian upheaval he hailed as the greatest world event since the French Revolution. And this glorification of the Jewish overthrow of Russia, it must be remembered, occurred before the world knew what Bolshevism was. And I would add to that that this international Jew account, it must be remembered, occurred before Stalin's willing executioners had even done their dirtiest work, which didn't occur until the 1930s. But even by this point, Henry Ford's writers of the International Jew were very, very critical of the Jewish role in Russia and the Jewish media, Jewish media in America's role in covering up the Jewish role in Russia. And I would urge you to listen to that whole series from beginning to end if you haven't already been following it. It's contemporary with the Mary Fagan murder and Leo Frank case. An even more direct precedent for the Leo Frank trial, and a precedent that must have been fresh in many people's minds at the time, even though it's almost all but forgotten today, is another violent crime that was actually committed by a Jew against a non-Jew. And it was a murder that had occurred in the summer of 1912, so a little less than a year before the murder of Mary Fagan. It was national news at the time, and that's the case of Nathan Schwartz, who was a 23-year-old Jew living in New York City in the Bronx, where, by the way, Leo Frank had lived and his family was still living. And this 23-year-old Jew had a criminal record of previous sexual assault on at least one other young girl. I think she was 13 years old when it came to light that he had murdered a 12-year-old girl named Julia Connors, about the same age as Mary Fagan, who was 13, going on 14, and is also described similarly. One account described her as unusually well-developed. So in other words, just like Mary Fagan being a good-looking young girl, that Julia Connors must have been as well. Now, how can we be sure that Nathan Schwartz committed the murder? Well, he confessed. That's the main difference with Leo Frank and why you never hear about this case, even though it is almost a direct parallel. This is where it deviates. Schwartz confessed. First, he confessed to his own father in private. Remember how Frank purportedly confessed to his own wife. And the exchange went very similarly. His father advised Nathan Schwartz to kill himself, but he ended up giving him money to help him get away. And Nathan Schwartz also got in contact with his brother in private, who didn't want to have anything to do with him, but gave him clothes to help him get away. To make a long story short, and this is a case that I could go into almost as much detail as the Leo Frank Mary Fagan case, except that it's greatly truncated, and not much about it is known today, and I'd have to go back to the original sources, really. 12 days later, Nathan Schwartz's body was found. He had killed himself by inhaling gas, lighting gas, in the apartment he had rented. But he left behind some suicide notes. And the suicide notes are, I think they reflect his mind. They say, "I want to say that if I will happen to be revived in order to be executed, why, I will take that medicine just the same. I'm sorry I done it, but I got crazy, as I often do, and you can't blame me nor anyone." And he also wrote, "I am guilty and am insane. It was caused by the beautiful makeup of women." So he was admitting his guilt of the crime, and it was really a heinous crime. And yet at the same time, he was denying it, saying it wasn't his fault. And so this precedent was clear in the minds of the people who were watching the Mary Fagan murder and Leo Frank trial unfold the very next year. I think it is worth reading here the details of the concise description that I found of the case. He lured her to a flat occupied by his parents and their family. As soon as she passed the door, he seized her by the throat, overpowered her, and threw her to the floor when she became insensible. He then carried her to the roof and from there down a vacant flat in the adjoining house and into a bathroom. In this flat, he made about 20 jabs into her back with a knife, slashed her throat and forearms, and stabbed her in the heart. At about 9:30, he thought the child dead. He stripped her in his father's flat of her clothing, except a union suit. It was found that he had made 41 rents in this garment with his knife. He then returned to his father's flat and procured a soapbox, which he carried to the place of the murder. He crowded the girl and her clothing into this box, having cut off a great part of her hair. He did that apparently to hide, to keep the police from recognizing who she was. The details of the finding of the girl the next morning, barely alive, her death soon after, and the action of the police have no scientific importance. This was in a medical journal. This was these rough details were given the year after the murder, in January of 1913, so just before the Leo Frank trial, before the murder of Mary Fagan. But it's a gruesome account here how he left her for dead. She still wasn't dead after all of that abuse, and she died shortly after she was discovered. So there's a precedent, and that must have been in the minds of the investigators and the jury on the Frank case. So this brings me to Jim Conley, and it does look like I'll have time to start Jim Conley at least. Now, the thing about Jim Conley is Jim Conley was the black sweeper. That was his job at the pencil factory. And that he was another suspect in the crime from early on, along with Newt Lee, the black night watchman. After Newt Lee was cleared, suspicion fell on Jim Conley. And Jim Conley is so prominent in the case, mainly because the Jews have made him prominent. He was a standout. His testimony was seen as standing out in the conviction of Frank. And Jews have made a big deal about Conley in the wake of the trial as well, saying basically that Conley did it. That they basically acknowledge that somebody must have committed the murder. If Frank didn't do it, if Frank was wrongly, falsely accused, wrongly convicted and wantonly murdered, then somebody else must have done the crime. And if Frank didn't do it, they insist that somebody else must have, and their scapegoat, their preferred scapegoat, is Jim Conley. So we come back now to the 100 Reasons That Leo Frank Is Guilty article. And in fact, the very first point that article makes is only Leo Frank had the opportunity to be alone with Mary Fagan. And he admits that he was alone with her in his office when she came to get her pay. And in fact, he was completely alone with her on the second floor. Had Jim Conley been the killer, he would have had to attack her practically right at the entrance to the building where he sat almost all day, where people were constantly coming, and where several witnesses noticed Conley with no assurance of even a moment of privacy. Item 22 from that article states that Jim Conley told police two obviously false narratives before finally breaking down and admitting that he was an accessory to Leo Frank in moving the body of Mary Fagan and in authoring, at Frank's direction, the death notes found near the body in the basement. These notes, ostensibly from Mary Fagan, but written in semi-literate Southern black dialect, seemed to point to the night watchman as the killer. To a rapt audience of investigators and factory officials, Conley reenacted his and Frank's conversations and movements on the day of the killing. Investigators and even some observers, who were very skeptical at first, felt that Conley's detailed narrative had the ring of truth. Item 23. At trial, the leading and most expensive criminal defense lawyers in the state of Georgia could not trip up Jim Conley or shake him from his story. Item 24. Conley stated that Leo Frank sometimes employed him to watch the entrance to the factory while Frank chatted, quote-unquote chatted, with the teenage girl employees upstairs. Conley said that Frank admitted that he had accidentally killed Mary Fagan when she resisted his advances and sought his help in the hiding of the body and the writing of the black dialect death notes that attempted to throw suspicion on the night watchman. Conley said that he was supposed to come back later to burn Mary Fagan's body in return for $200, but fell asleep and did not return. I'll skip a point here. 25 is redundant with 27. 26, hair that looked like Mary Fagan's was found on a metal room lathe immediately next to where Conley said he found her body, where she had apparently fallen after her altercation with Leo Frank. Item 27, body spots, blood spots were found exactly where Conley said he dropped Mary Fagan's body while he was trying to move it. This is separate from the lathe where the hair was found. Conley could not have known this, that blood had been found there. If he was making up his story, this is a coincidence too fantastic to be accepted. Item 28, a piece of Mary Fagan's lacy underwear was looped around her neck, apparently in a clumsy attempt to hide the deeply indented marks of the rope which had been used to strangle her. No murderer could possibly believe that the detectives would be fooled for an instant by such a deception. In other words, if Conley had done that, nobody... There was no reason for Conley to have done that, because it wouldn't have fooled detectives, because they would have seen, they would have taken it off and seen the choking. But a murderer who needed to make another man's, a murderer who needed another man's help, in other words, Leo Frank, for a few minutes in disposing of the body, might indeed believe that it would serve briefly to conceal the real nature of the crime from his assistant, perhaps mistaking it for a lace collar. Item 29. If Conley was the killer, and it had to be either Conley or Frank, and I think that's a really good point. It had to be either Conley or Frank. They were the only ones in the building who really had the motive or opportunity to do it. Then he moved the body of Mary Fagan by himself if it was Conley alone. And the lacy loop around Mary Fagan's neck would serve absolutely no purpose in such a scenario. That's a little bit redundant with the previous point. There is some redundancy in these points. Item 30. The dragging marks on the basement floor leading to where Mary Fagan's body was dumped near the furnace began at the elevator, exactly matching Jim Conley's version of events. That hinges on some other detail of the case about whether she was thrown down a hatch or brought down the elevator. My own reading of those details is that it's pretty much just a bunch of nonsense that doesn't amount to much. Item 55. Much is made by Frank partisans of Georgia Governor Slayton's 1915 decision to commute Frank's sentence from death by hanging to life imprisonment. Well, let me just stop with the Conley stuff for this week, and I'll pick it up the next time. I want to conclude here by saying, how do we make sense out of the Jewish refrain that Frank was wrongly accused, falsely convicted, and wantonly murdered? The way to recognize it or to reconcile it is to recognize that whites made a terrible mistake. They thought that this apparently industrious, intelligent, law-abiding segment of their white society was only peculiar because of religious views. They didn't realize that those religious views disguised a people who are biologically distinct and whose identity boils down to a separate idea of themselves, hostile to whites, which viewed whites and anyone else they live amongst as the other. Whites made the mistake of trusting Jews, of thinking Jews saw themselves as part of white society.